Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
Howdy, everybody, and thanks for joining us here again on Expanded Perspectives. I'm Cam Hale. Joining me, as always, is the, I would like to say, maestro of the soundboard, but it's been a difficult run here the last few weeks, Mr. Kyle Filio-Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yeah, it's been crazy. We're not going to talk about it too much because the last couple of episodes we've been bringing it up constantly, but I think we're finally finished 100%. So.
Well, I'd like to give a big thanks to a good friend of ours named Tim. Tim is a sound engineer, basically, is what he does much recording. He did some work with Pantera, and he's worked with a bunch of bands, but Tim's been doing this for about 35 years, so I finally hit him up. Pride, you know, I was just like, oh, we can do this ourselves. So I finally hit up Tim. Tim slung over here and run through everything, and he kind of lined me and Kyle out, and we got a pretty good, it was almost like an education you'd get firsthand. You know, it's one of those things, it's like you're learning like an apprenticeship. It was really neat, but still he wouldn't get to talking about stuff, and I'm like, dude, I don't know what you're saying, man. You're gonna have to do some, you got to slow it down and talk to me in dumb terms, because I'm not getting this at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he's a professional, that's what he does for a living. I mean,
yeah,
he's, you know, he's looking at our setup and he's like, man, your studio is pretty good, but this is, you know, it's nothing compared to what he's used to. And he was able to figure out our problem within a matter of, like, I don't know, 5 seconds maybe?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, so, exactly.
You know.
Well, anyways, folks, hope y'all had a great Easter. Hope everybody was safe and everybody got their belly full of food and hugged some family members and whatnot. But we're going to jump into the fun. We've been under the stress, and now we're ready to kind of let this thing fly. And Kyle, I showed you a picture earlier whenever we got in here, and I want to tell everybody about that. Now, this comes from Cryptozoology News. And there is a fella from Switzerland that is convinced that he has proof of Bigfoot in Switzerland. All right. Now, this actually happened last week, and he claims it's real live proof of the existence of Bigfoot in Europe. Now, his name is Dago Cleo, and he's a Canadian Swiss citizen and an avid geocacher, also known as Bernie. So I guess he goes by Bernie.
Weekend at Bernie's?
Yeah, I guess that's what's going on. I don't know. But he says he was out in the Swiss woods hunting for caches, whatever that is, when he captured a visual anomaly. Now, he says, I wouldn't have found it if not being for iPhoto. Now, Bernie's an older fella, so when you get a load of this, he says, when I put my selfie into iPhoto, it recognizes so-called faces. So he said it recognized mine, but then it was asking me, who is the face in the background? Of course, I say it like that. Now, it didn't really ask him that, but of course, it threw that little square up. For anybody that owns some Apple equipment, you know, whenever you got all, like, tagging people, it'll throw, like, a square up and all that. Well, he says, of course, I thought there's no face in the background. So we got to looking. Now, he says, until he zoomed in and realized that indeed somebody or something was looking at him. Now, he claims the photograph contains a close-up, of course, it's of his face, as he poses for, of course, a selfie there in the woods, but in the background, there is a very strange, I guess you could call it a pattern or a shape, that looks like it's formed by the leaves on the tree there. Now, Bernie says that he's got a black face and the face was coming out, and you can almost see the fur on his chest in this picture. Now, I showed Kyle this picture, and
yeah,
first of all, folks, he's in the selfie. Oh, Bernie is. And this, the normal photograph, it's way back in the background. There's a few trees. And I don't know if you could say it was a real face or it's just one of those anomalies like we always talk about. You want to say it looks like something, so your mind instantly says that. Well, I think the computer, you know, does the same thing. Just because the computer says, hey, this looks like a face, doesn't necessarily mean it's a face, because they zoom in on the photo and it still just looks like leaves and a few dark spots to me. Now, granted, it is in the shape of a face, but it looks like a giant Polynesian mask with its tongue sticking out, if that's really what the face is you're looking at.
I don't think it's a face. I mean, it's just, you know, the shadows of the leaves and stuff that it, man, it kind of look like a face. I mean, it's the same thing when you see like a picture of the Virgin Mary on a piece of toast.
Yeah.
Just the way it came out, it does kind of look like a face, but, you know, I don't believe that it's really a face. And I don't know why, even, I mean, I don't pan over my photographs of, you know, whenever we take photos somewhere and looking in every corner for, you know, possible.
Maybe you should start.
I mean, you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I know what you mean.
People always catch this. I'm like, yeah. How did you even see that? I mean, if you had not circled it on the screen and showed me where to look, I wouldn't even have noticed that, would you?
No, no. And that's why he says he didn't notice it till iPhoto picked it out.
But he thinks it's a Sasquatch.
Well, that's part of the headline grab, I guess, that really got me going. When I love looking for these stories, but he says he has proof of it in Switzerland, and then he claimed in the headline of the story he has real life proof. This isn't real life proof.
That's
not what
point,
this
yeah.
is. Yeah, I was like, what the heck? So, folks, run over there to cryptozoologynews.com, pull it up. Like I said, here's the headline. The headline is, man convinced he has proof of Bigfoot in Switzerland. I don't think that's what this is. It looks just like some, I hope it's there, like I've always said, and I'm not hating on the guy, but still, that picture is a little bit suspicious of just leaves and branches to me.
Yeah, well, moving on, we're going to be, this whole episode is going to be dedicated to kind of UFOs, so I got a bunch of UFO stories.
Hook me up, bro.
Now, this first one is about how hundreds report UFOs in Canuck Chase, UK, so our friends over there in the UK. Now, this comes from the Inquisitor. It says that hundreds of residents of Canuck Chase in Staffordshire, UK, witnessed a UFO flying very low, slowly, and loudly in the sky over the homes in the area on March 24th, 2015. The incident, which took place around 9 p.m. local time, caused a great stir, even in the area that has become notorious over the years as a UFO hotspot. Now, according to local witnesses, minutes before the object became visible in the air, a very loud droning noise could be heard. And soon, a massive aircraft appeared, moving slowly over the homes with three red lights. One person says it was flying so low that many feared it was going to crash. And they thought it was, you know, they weren't sure what it was, according to, you know, the Birmingham Mail. One guy said, my house was rumbling and I'm still shaking. It was slow and it was huge. Way too slow for fighter jets. It flew directly over our house. It made a sharp left turn and carried on. It was stupid loud. My heart is still pounding. I heard it and threw and thought, that's low. Man, that's low. I thought it might have been a plane that was going to crash or something. It looked like one big thing with three lights. It scared the blank out of me. I heard it very low and very loud. Something seemed like it lasted for about 3 minutes. Even the dog went crazy, but it wasn't a fighter jet. It was way too big. Three lights on one rear end and one on each wing. Usually, commercial planes have flashing lights, but this just had three solid red lights. It could have been a large military plane, I guess, but it didn't seem to be. Now, one paranormal investigator named Lee Brickley described his experience on the Paranormal Canuck Chase blog as the UFO flew over that area. He described a noise similar to the engine of an old World War II bomber. So that's odd, right?
That is strange.
Now, he says that before anything could be seen with the naked eye, there was a deep and very loud droning sound. After 3 minutes, the craft came into sight. It seemed incredibly large and astonishingly low in the sky, with, like the other person says, same thing, three red lights that were easily noticeable. Says the UFO traveled very slowly, and many people thought it was about to crash. I mean, his story sounds almost verbatim to the other person's story. And it says this continued for a few minutes, and then after that, the craft just disappeared. Now, you know, what is that? What the heck could it be? A UFO that sounds like a World War II bomber?
Yeah, right.
Like a prop-driven plane?
Well, maybe.
I mean, that's the first thing.
Cutbacks.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if I see something unusual in the sky and I don't know what it is, but it sounds like a prop-driven airplane, I'm just going to assume it's probably an airplane.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a plane. Why would you automatically go, I don't care what it sounds like, that's definitely a UFO.
Well,
I mean, I don't know.
I don't either. Yeah, because the lighting thing is a little strange, too.
Well, and it's like hovering real low, too. I mean, what kind of plane would do that?
A helicopter? It sounds prop-driven?
It doesn't. They didn't say it sounded like a helicopter, but it could be, right?
Yeah, maybe. Man, see, these stories are so hard to, whenever you don't get a clear view of them, it's such a hard thing to put your finger on. Look, they're definitely a UFO, because it was unidentified.
Right, right.
You know, and that's where people get mistaken, is you start thinking of UFO. It is unidentified. It is something that we don't know what it is. They didn't know what it is. Now, that's not saying it's an alien craft, you know.
Exactly. But, well, that's exactly what the article talks about. It says there was a bunch of people that thought it's definitely an alien UFO flying over the area. But many other people think that it was most likely just a prototype of a top-secret military aircraft that's under development right now. Now, Brickley, the guy that was doing some of the research, he ruled out the earlier explanation and said that it was an aircraft from a nearby airport in distress. So some people think it was even a crashing airplane, but, I mean, it never crashed. So he said he checked into some flight tracking services, and none of them had reported anything in the area. So who knows?
Well, I got something crazy for you, too, as far as talking about those lights from our buddies over there at Open Minds. This is Roger Marsh actually wrote this. Apparently, there was a military witness reported seeing a helicopter chasing, now a black helicopter, chasing what they said was a cigar-shaped UFO. Now, this it was come to happen in Georgia. It says there at Moultrie, and there was a fellow with a military background reported watching a cigar-shaped UFO being followed by a black helicopter. Now, Kyle, get out your pen and paper, because it's case number 63045 of the Mutual UFO Network, sir.
Okay, I wrote it down. I love to keep track of the numbers.
You got to keep up with this case. Now, it says the witness spent 6 years in the military, with 4 of those years working with special operations, and most recently as a contractor for the Army, basically training troops and things before they deployed to the combat zone, and also would earn some several awards, 2 awards from the U.S. Army Special Forces. Now, the witness says that he has seen every type of aircraft and helicopter that the U.S. military and its branches has. So that's what he's been involved in. So
right,
He's used to that.
But very familiar with it.
Very familiar. But at 11:10 p.m. on February 2nd of this year, he stepped outside and witnessed a craft that could not be identified. He says, "I stepped out to smoke a cigarette, and as often as I do, I stare up at the stars. Traveling from the north, heading south, I noticed the small cigar-shaped silhouette with 4 bright lights heading in a perfect straight line. The 2 lights in the middle were bigger and brighter." That instantly makes me think of like a Starship Cruiser, where you got the 2 looks, you know what I mean? Like the small engines on the outside edge and the 2 big ones in the middle. That's what it makes me think of.
Well, the big one in the middle, is that's because that's how you beam them down.
Yeah,
or beam people back up. I mean, it's got to be, you know, big enough to, you not just people, but equipment.
And cars.
Cars, whatever, yeah.
Well, it says the witness then noticed an identified object following the UFO. He says, "I then noticed the black helicopter, which he believes was a Black Hawk or a Jayhawk, and I could clearly see the light on the tail to make out the helicopter. About halfway through the sighting, the 2 middle lights on the unidentified aircraft got extremely bright for about 10 seconds and then dimmed back down. It was odd to me because the unidentified aircraft flew in such a precise route, and the fact that I could tell what type this aircraft could possibly be. I couldn't tell what type of aircraft this could possibly be," says. And says neither aircraft had at any time made any sound whatsoever. So not only could he not hear the cigar, but he also couldn't hear the helicopter following it. Then, of course, you can go to the MUFON, like I said, and you can pull up these. He's made a couple of sketches of what it looked like as it was following it, and the lights and the whole thing. There's several pictures. Now, of course, Moultrie is the county seat there in the largest city of Colquitt County, Georgia, which is a population of about 14,000 people, which is where this was. Now, Georgia is currently a UFO alert level 5. Now, they say with 0.71 sightings per million population, based, of course, on MUFON's 2015 statistics for February. So Georgia has received a total of 7 UFO reports in the month of March. So it's bumping on up pretty good, too.
Yeah, well, speaking of statistics based on states, that's exactly what I'm going to talk about next. Did you see this at the ABC News? They ranked the top 10 states with the highest number of UFO reports.
Really?
Then they said, now, there's already been 1,177 sightings reported to the National UFO Reporting Center so far this year, with 353 of them just in March. So that's a lot, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Now, they also said that there's some notable sightings just in the last week, one in Portugal, one in Alaska, and one in Washington. Now, in one of the reports, a woman from Sitka, Alaska, said she heard a strange ping sound in her home last Wednesday and claimed her four-year-old son witnessed a disc-shaped craft outside of their home. The report came with a drawing made by her son of the alleged craft. Now, if you're in the mood to go UFO hunting, or if you just want to have an extraterrestrial experience, you may want to visit these 10 states because they have the highest number of UFO sightings since 1998, according to Peter Davenport. Now, you've seen this guy before. He's the one that monitors, you know, the National UFO Reporting Center. And you'd think it was a big building or something. It's just like him sitting at a desk in his house. And
that's
it. And he takes, I mean, calls literally every night, day and night.
It's just a full-time job.
And he's been cataloging it, much like Albert Rosales, does with the humanoids. So which state do you think is number one as far as the United States? You got a 1 in 50 chance, my friend.
1 in 50 chance. I'm going with California.
California, you are correct.
Score!
11,202 so far this year, with the most recent sighting being on Ladera Ranch on March 22nd, 2015 at 9:35 p.m. The person said, "I was on my patio and saw something fall out of the sky, straight down. It was green and looked like a flame was coming out of the back end of it." That's it? That sounds like a shooting star to me, right?
Yeah, right.
I don't know, but that was the most. What's number two, do you think?
I can't even put my finger on number two. Now, I know I don't want to make anybody mad, but I know how wacky the state of Florida gets from time to time because I love the tweet of
Florida.
Are you on the same website? I'm really not. So I know that because I know Texas has got to be in the top five. I would have to say it's going to be California. This is going to be my list. I'm going to guess top five. California, Florida. Man, I'm going to have to probably say Texas. Then I'm going to have to jump over and probably go with like Kentucky and then maybe like Pennsylvania, maybe Indiana. I'll go Indiana.
Okay. Well, you're pretty close. So definitely in the first two, you were right. It was California. Number two is Florida.
Yes.
With 5,113 sightings so far this year. Now, number three is Washington.
Oh, dang.
With 5,004. Now, Texas is number four. So you were close. 4,359. So far, and the most recent one was in College Station, March 25th, 2015, at 8:30 p.m. The witness reported seeing a red and green orb moving at an incredible speed.
Now, look, you can't take they're a bunch of Aggies down there, man. You cannot take their word for it.
He said he saw this while he was looking at Jupiter through a telescope.
When he just got done drinking margaritas at Chimmy's.
I don't know. It says what drew my attention was its curving motion and abrupt changes in speed. From close to a dead stop to full speed, almost instantaneously. The speed of this object was far greater than any aircraft or satellite and could not be seen by the naked eye, only through my telescope.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
Now, number five is New York State.
Oh, damn it. So what, I go 3 for 5?
You were pretty good. 3,837 so far this year. The most recent one was in the Bronx. Number six, Arizona, 3,212. Number seven, Pennsylvania, 3,142. Number eight, Cam, Ohio, 2,907. Up there by Jim Harold. I bet he wondered if he's ever outside looking up in the stars.
Oh, I'm sure.
Trying to look at stuff. Number nine, Michigan. And number 10, North Carolina.
Oh, whoop, Micah.
Right? He always talks about sitting outside after he does the show.
It's Chris Hayes, Matt Oakley, and all them.
Staring up into the heavens.
Caleb. In trouble.
For the International Space Station and stuff. But anyways, that's the top 10. Pretty cool. I don't know how you would have any better chance of seeing one. You know, if you drove somewhere to one of those states, you could probably see one from any state. I mean, but if you're interested, there you go. If you want to look at any of these stories, you can go to the website and I'll put the links up there. Or you can just go to iTunes and look in the show notes portion in iTunes and it'll have the links on there.
There you go. Yeah. Well, folks, before we jump into the break, I'm going to tell y'all right quick who we're going to be talking to today. We're going to be talking to Miss Artie Sixkiller Clark. We're going to be discussing her book, Sky People, The Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. Now, she did a lot of work in this. Now, literally, she was on a 7-year adventure. It took her from 03 to 2010. She went through all this, through Belize and Honduras, Mexico, Guatemala, and basically sitting down with people there, locals in all these areas, and collected a bunch of stories on what they considered the sky gods or the giants or even aliens and the indigenous people. Now, here's the really wild thing. She visited 89 archaeological sites on her way through there and actually covered more than 12,000 miles and nearly 100 individual interviews, narrowing it down to what she put in this book.
Yeah, it's an incredible book, and I suggest you read it if you're interested in these subjects. And the thing I liked the most about the book is the fact that almost every story that was in there was ones I've never heard of before.
Yeah.
I've literally read tons of books where it's like just rehashing the same story. I mean, I don't know how many times I can read about Roswell or the Rendlesham Forest incident or something. It just, they repeat themselves. There's stories in here I've never heard of, and that's my favorite part. And my other favorite part about the people that she was interviewing is these are people in remote areas that doesn't, you know, they're not seeking money. I mean, there's no reason. Why would an old man who's grew up as a farmer his entire life, who's in his 80s, make up a story like that?
Yeah. And it's, some of these stories are very intricate and sound really, really out there. Even the ones that we have her discuss sound really, really out there in the book. That's just a portion of what she discusses in this book. There's a ton of them. But with like what Kyle said, you're like, why would you make up such a crazy story if that's all you were? Just an everyday old farmer. That's all it was. I mean, you would have to have a vast imagination to make it up, and then all for nothing, basically, would be for the whole thing. So we had a great time talking to her. Now, you may notice a little bit of difference with the sound. We had a hard time with the sound whenever we called her. We did it, of course, through Skype, the whole thing. She's up in the mountains of Montana. We had to go back. We had to do a lot of work and redo this whole interview and kind of do a little editing. So it may sound a little bit different, but we did the best. I think everybody's going to enjoy it. So I guess we will catch y'all on the other side and get ready. So you're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Alrighty, folks, we got a treat today. On the line with us, this young lady here holds a degree in history, English, parapsychology, and educational leadership, and has done a great job writing a wonderful book. On the line today with us, we have Dr. Artie Sixkiller Clark. Dr. Clark, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
We are doing wonderful. Thank you. Now, this book looks like it took a lot of time. Where did you find the time for this?
I retired in 2006 from the university. So after that, I had a lot more time to spare, get out and do things. And so I was able to spend a lot more time.
Well, looks like you spent it perfectly, in my opinion.
Well, thank you. It was a trip of love. It really was. It was a journey that I just had to take.
Now, you wrote your first book in 2012 called Encounters with the Star People. Is that correct?
Right. And that featured stories of American Indians in the 48 states and Alaska Natives. And this one was in Mesoamerica, mostly Maya people I interviewed in Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico.
Well, the first book was great, and some of the stories of the American Indians is really what drew us in. But in this book, it seems to be more widely accepted in South America than it is here. Now, what do you think?
Well, you know, I don't know if that is true or not, but I think that one of the things I tried to show in Sky People was that what was happening in that part of the world, even though we don't hear about it as much, is that the stories of the people there who don't have access to the television shows that we have access, nor to the books that we have access to, are still telling the same kinds of stories that are told in areas where UFO, you know, stories are on TV and in books and at conferences. And so they really don't vary that much. But I think in Mexico it's more accepted because, you know, even a lot of the politicians have come out there and announced, acceptance of UFOs.
And that's crazy because here they do everything they can do to make sure that they distance themselves from the stories or anything along the lines of ufology.
Oh, I know. And it just doesn't make sense because people around the world are admitting that that this has happened. I even read a story not too long ago about the Russian Navy who talked about these of finding these UFOs and these beings underwater. And, this is the Russian Navy talking mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. And they said that during the encounter with them, three of their Navy men died. And so that's just an amazing story when you stop and think about mm-hmm. it.
Well, one part of this book that I loved and really appreciated was the story of the Mayan people who actually claimed themselves that they are the aliens or transplanted here due to the overpopulation of another planet.
Well, and this is something that approximately half of the elders that I talk to, tell that story. And the other half, do not. They are not sure where they came from. But there is an agreement that they came from the East. Now, the thing that's unique about the Maya is that, you always read about stories about the people that once they were on Earth, first you have the creation stories, and then you have somebody coming to them and giving them all this great knowledge. The thing that's so unique about the Maya is that when they arrived in that part of the world, they already had their knowledge. They already knew about the cosmos. They didn't have somebody appearing like the Aztecs, for example, believed that Cortez and his henchmen were gods. Mm-hmm. So they accepted them. But the Maya didn't do that because they didn't have a god that taught them all this kind of stuff. They arrived with that knowledge. So I found them to be an extremely unique people.
Yeah, you even mentioned in the book that the Mayans didn't perceive the Spaniards as being that technologically advanced and that they didn't think that they were advanced people at all.
No, they said we came from an advanced society and we didn't see them as advanced. And I thought that was a very interesting perspective. And explain, well, what happened to an advanced society like the Maya? Well, as many elders told me, when scientists today say that what happened to the Maya was a 100-year-old drought and that they simply abandoned their cities because they couldn't support cities of 50,000 and 100,000. And that's probably what did happen. And they just went into the forest in small family groups and in order to survive, because there's still 15 million Maya living in that part of the world. Cortez didn't kill them all, and the Catholic Church didn't kill them all. By the time Cortez had arrived, there were only two small cities that were still occupied.
Oh, wow. So it was towards the end of their culture.
Right. At least as far as they're living in the cities, they went into the jungle and, there were groups of Maya that were not even discovered until 1958 that were living out in the jungle, untouched by any kind of civilization, and still carrying on their traditions, their religion, their language. Everything had been untouched by modern civilization. And if you ever get to that part of the world and go into the jungle, you could realize how that could happen.
Well, they could easily go and slip off the map, couldn't they?
Right, you could.
For real.
You know,
yeah.
And the thing of it is, the jungle is so filled with fruits and things to eat, you know, and it doesn't, and there's such a long growing season in that part of the world that, you know, you wouldn't have, it wouldn't take much to survive in that part of, you know, and. Now, the Yucatan is quite arid, but a lot of the places there have a lot of water, too. The jungle does.
Well, there's a few stories out of the book I'd like to talk to you about, and one of them was Chapter 3, and it took place in Belize. And the chapter was called A Disc in the Sky, and it's about Raul, Manuel, and Miguel. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Oh, yes. Weren't they a pair? I met Raul. He was an elder who actually lived in Guatemala, as I recall, and I went to his house, and he was very feeble. He told me that as a little boy that he had. He would go about and dig up things and plant things all around his little village to make it better. And that he always wanted the people to have fruit trees and things. So he was always doing something like that to make their property much better. But one day he was out in the forest, and a spacecraft came and took him on board, and he was very concerned about it because it was his. The next day was to be his birthday, and he was afraid he was going to miss his birthday. And he said that he stayed with them. They showed him around their floating disc in the sky that he called it a floating disc, and he said that they let him go home. They brought him back home in time for his birthday. And sitting beside him was this little boy by the name of Miguel. And Miguel was tutoring Miguel to become Miguel was his apprentice. And he told me, I'd been a star traveler since I was Miguel's age. He said it was the first time I went to the stars when I was almost 9 years old. He said that he talked about when he was a child, they would take him there. They would find him in the forest, and they would dig up plants in the forest and trees. And then they would take them to this floating disc in the sky, and that was they had a nursery there, basically, is what he was saying, and that they would plant those trees and they would nurture them, and he would teach them what he had learned about how to take care of them and how you use them and what they were good for. And he talked about the children that were also on the spacecraft. They were, even though he couldn't speak their language and they couldn't speak his, that they understood each other. He said there were many languages that were spoken on the disc, but everybody understood one another. And he said that he would work with these other little children in planting all of these different kinds of plants and trees. And he described the craft as a huge silver sombrero. He said it floated in the sky high above the earth. He said it was lighted, but the lights were kind of green everywhere. But in the plant room, he said at night, I could look out and I could almost touch the stars. He said the disc was circular. there were living quarters for the workers, and he said there were different levels, and he said, I think the scientists were on the top level, the guys who ran the ship, he said. He talked about going to their planet, and their planet being one that was like a desert. He's described it as a purple-gray land. There were no trees or rivers, only dust and rocks on the surface. But when you went underground, he said, the people lived underground, and they had tapped deep underwater reservoirs, and they had water even for swimming, he said. And they grew these crops that they had, these plants and trees that they had collected. On Earth, they would take them back, and they would plant them in that environment. He said everything was grown by artificial light. He said that they called him an Earth advisor, and he tells the children about life on Earth and the jungle and the forest, and he says, I tell them old stories. And I continue to teach them about the trees and the plants. Now, he has been doing this since he was 8 years old. So he's an old man now, you know, in his 90s. And he told me that that the children treat him with great respect, and that he continues going back, and that soon he's going to take Miguel. And Miguel will go with him, and he will take over after he's gone. So it's a wonderful story.
Well, it was even backed up by many people in the village. I mean, he would go missing for weeks at a time, and then they would later find him in the woods.
And then his family was always worried about him, because he would come up missing, and he'd be gone for a week or two. And many times they had seen the craft. The villagers had seen the craft. And this is a story that he told.
And then the book would actually go on to talk about how they would say that they would actually pay him.
Yes, you know, that was an interesting story, because I went back to see him the next time I was there, and he had passed away. And so I went to on the hunt for Miguel, and I found his mother, and she said, well, she had cleaned out his place after he died, and he had left all of his possessions and everything he owned to Miguel. And it was very important for Miguel to go to school. And so he had left everything he had, and he, with directions that the proceeds of his belongings was to go to Miguel. And what she found was this box of gold bars. And so she told me that she had put Miguel in a private school. And I said, well, she said, I took the gold bars to the bank. And I said, well, and put them in the bank for his schooling. And I said, well, were there any distinguishing marks? And she said, well, now that you mention it, there were. She said, I probably made a mistake, didn't I?
And then there was even times where they said that Miguel had been missing or had vanished.
He was coming up missing at the school.
Yeah.
Right. And his teachers would call her and say, you know, Miguel is missing. And she said, well, lock him in his room. And they locked him in his room, but that didn't do any good either, because he still came up missing. And so it was assumed that Miguel had taken Raul's place and was, you know, literally had taken over where the grandfather had left off.
It's almost like the Sky People themselves already knew of Manuel's, like, shamanic ability, and knew that he would be the man to go get if they needed some help to grow some things.
And, of course, you know, actually, you know, when you go to that part of the world, you find out that the Maya are so close to nature that almost any of them could tell you what Raul was teaching the aliens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the Maya, for most part, still live, the full-blood Maya still live as in the old ways. I mean, they live in these small huts with dirt floors. They they have these little gardens where they grow corn and peppers and a few vegetables, and they have their fruit trees and everything in their backyard, and they raise pigs and they raise chickens and turkeys, and that's the way they live. And so they really haven't changed. You know, when I say there's 15 million Maya, I mean 15 million full-blooded Maya. You know, the next group are the Mestizos that are half Maya, half Spaniard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they take up the bulk of that part of the world. And then you've got the Spanish blood only, and basically they're the ruling class, or the, you know, the big owners of companies and things.
One of the great stories in the book is about an accidental cover-up by a fella named Lewis. Now, can you tell me about that?
And that's one of my favorite stories. Of course, the character was, like Raul, was another one of my favorite interviewees. I mean, he was just like Raul. He was an amazing man and had an amazing life. When I met him, he told me that he spent 75 years at the ancient site Copan working there, and he started working there when he was 5 years old. And he told me how when the archaeologist first came there to his to Copan, a man by the name of Herbert Spinden, who was he was the assistant curator of anthropology at the Natural History Museum in New York. And he gave him 10 cents, he said. And he was kind of the runner, he called himself. He said he would bring their lunches, and he would run and get them water, and whatever they needed, he would run and get. And Spinden one day told him if he had learned English, that he had give him a raise. And by the time he was 8 years old, he said, I was speaking good English. And he said that he gave him a 25-cent raise. And then when the Spinden left and the Carnegie archaeologist came in, he said, they were so surprised to see a boy who could speak good English. He said, they gave me 50 cents a day.
Which was big money back then.
Yeah, and he said that was amazing. He said to make that kind of money, because I could help my family. And he said another way I helped my family was on the weekends. My cousins and I, we'd go out into the mountains, and we'd go into the caves, and we'd search for artifacts. And if the archaeologists liked them, they would buy them and ship them back to their university. And he said one day he and his cousins were out, and they came upon the remnants of a skeleton in a silver suit. He said it was about a meter long, and that would make it about 3 feet tall. He said it was silver from the top of its head to the bottom of its feet. And when I asked him about, you know, I said, well, tell me about the head covering. And he said, well, it reminded him of a coffee can turned upside down. And he said it had a hose that came out of it and went into a chest compartment. And there were several different color buttons on the chest. And he said that, you know, the old people used to tell stories about the silver man who came to the mountains, and they came on a silver disc that spit fire. And the day sometimes would stay only a few days, and sometimes they would stay for months. And he says, I think I found one of those little men, and that he died there. And he talked about finding this tablet beside him that had these foreign caricatures on them, and he said it wasn't our writing, because I knew Mayan writing, he said. And then he and his cousin carried this little silver man back to the archaeologist's tent. And when the archaeologist saw it, he said they got very excited. And I said, he heard one of them say that they should ship this back to the university immediately. And he said that I said, well, did you see it again? And he said, no. He said, I saw a box, and I think they put it in there, and they shipped it back, he says, because I never saw it again, and I never heard any conversation about it. And he said that somebody at that university knows about that little man in that silver suit, and they haven't told anybody. And he said, you know, I knew after that I'd made the biggest mistake of my life. I should never have given that little man to those archaeologists, because he said not only did they keep it a secret, but they kept it a secret from everybody so that no one would ever know the Mayan connection with the stars and the people from the stars. And he said, and so I gave away part of our history when I did that. And he said, I've never forgiven myself. And I felt so sorry for him. I was so touched by his story that he will definitely go down in my books as one of my favorites.
Well, how about you tell us about Chapter 35 in Bonham Pack?
Well, you know, he was a Lacandone Indian. And, you know, the Lacandones are the ones I were telling you that had not been found until 1958.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that they had a star map. He said their legends tell of the birth of the heavens, and much of their ancient knowledge, he said, has now been confirmed by astronomers. And I said, well, can you tell me anything about this star map? And he said, well, it's lost now, but I can tell you that it mapped the stars, and the planets where there were inhabitants were marked, he said, and the sky gods chose this place for us. He said the jungles could feed our people, the soil was rich, and it was a good place for us to be. And one of his biggest fears, and I'm, you know, is that trying to keep his children away from the modern world. If you go to Bonham Pack, and you'll see the Lacandone Indians, they are very distinctive from the other Maya that you will meet, because most of the Maya in that part of the world have adopted Western dress, even though it may be more of a peasant style of dress. But the Lacandone wear these gown-like clothing. It's a homespun kind of dress. It's like a gown that gets them about their ankle, and both, all of them, the men, the women, the children, all dress alike. And they have long, flowing black hair, straight black hair down their backs. They don't braid it, or it's just long down their back. And his one of his biggest concerns that he mentioned to me is the fear of his children losing the old way. And he said that the tourists come there and the children look at these curious people, he said, and he said that his son even wears the clothes of the white man. He wears jeans and expensive boots and clothing, you know, and he was very, very sad about the people that were coming, because he thought that although he met with the white people as a shaman, he still didn't particularly like what he was doing, because he held ceremonies for them, you know. So basically he was living in two worlds, but was unhappy with what he was doing.
Now, Dr. Clark, what do you think sets the Mayans apart from other ethnic groups, including North American Indians?
I think what sets them apart is they haven't had the exposure to ufology as people in the United States have had, although the majority of the American Indians that I've interviewed haven't had a lot of exposure either. You know, they live in remote or isolated areas, and many of them didn't have TV. A lot of them don't even have telephone, you know, or electricity. So that's similar to what the Maya, though. They like those cell phones. I mean, even if they're just calling across the road, they have embraced those cell phones. And, of course, down there, they're just our pennies, you know, because those track phones came out of Mexico, I think. The richest man in Mexico was the one who put those track phones in Walmart. So they like their cell phones. And I see, you know, probably 60-70% of the people have cell phones. Not so much the kids, but the adults. I think they're more religious, and many of them explain some of the things that happened to them more in terms of biblical terms, because of the influence of evangelical preachers, perhaps, and other religious groups that are pretty strongly invested in that part of the world. I guess those will be the big differences.
What I really enjoyed about the book is there's so many stories that I've never heard of before. I mean, so many books on the topic of UFOs just keep rehashing the old stories, the Roswell incident, the Rendlesham Forest, things like that. And so many of the people that you interviewed in this book have now since died. And I love these stories.
Well, and the other thing that's so important is that I think that one of the things that researchers don't do is they're always looking for the big stories, and I'm interested in what happens to ordinary people, and particularly to indigenous people, because they have a different worldview, a different perspective on things than mainstream Western thought. And so it's been a journey of love for me to collect these stories and to go out in search of these stories, because they have the most remarkable stories to tell. And I have been able, through my interviews and through my books, to give voice to people that heretofore have not even been heard. Most people, in many situations, so many are not even welcome and don't have access to that group. And so I've just made myself available and part of those communities so that I could get those stories.
Yes, ma'am. I was going to ask you, you know, what prompted you to spend over 7 years, you know, conducting UFO research in Mesoamerica?
Well, you know, I started out, you know, when I was in high school, a teacher handed me a book about Robert Stevens John L. Stevens and Stephen Frederick Catherwood. And I just, you know, it was called Incidents of Travel in Central America, the Chiapas and the Yucatan. And when I took it back to her, I said, oh, I'm just in love with these two guys. I'm going to follow in their footsteps one day. And she said, well, you want to read Incidents of Travel in the Yucatan? That was the second book they wrote. Well, these were two guys that set out in 1839 in search of these ancient cities in the jungle that they had heard rumors about, and all their colleagues just laughed at them. They said, there isn't anything down there. You're just going on a wild goose chase. Well, of course, Catherwood was the artist and an architect by training, and he drew all the cities that they uncovered, and they visited 44. I was able to visit 89 during the course, but I simply at first was going to follow in their footsteps. It was just a trip for me.
But now you're an overachiever.
But then, you know, all these stories came out, all these books were written about ancient astronauts building these cities, not the Maya, and all this kind of stuff. And they were so ethnocentric from my perspective as an indigenous person. I felt a little bit of anger that, you know, here is somebody saying, well, you know, these Indians couldn't have possibly built these places. You know, they're too stupid or backward but they were built by, you know, somebody from the stars. And so it angered me a little bit. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to find the truth. I'm going to go down there. I'm going to look at their ancient stories. I'm going to look at their artifacts. I'm going to visit these cities. And I'm going to talk to the local people to see what they say. And, of course, as you know, after reading the book, it was a totally different story than, man, the ancient astronauts. And so that's what prompted me to do it. I just, and when I began, there was no way I could stop. I mean, I just fell in love with the region, the people, the food, the children, you know, everybody. And, you know, it reminded me so much of my own upbringing of, you know, people living a very simple life. You know, we had to carry water. We didn't have running water. We didn't have bathrooms, you know. We learned to do with very little, and that's what the people there were doing. And so when I went into these communities, it didn't bother me to wash dishes in a dish pan or carry water from, you know, a stream or a well. And so I just, you know, became one of them because that's the way I grew up, and I felt at home with them. And I think they realized that, and that's why I was able to get to those stories and to be able to record them.
Well, that's something that I kind of wanted to point it out, because it seemed like you had a certain air to you, or a mannerism that kind of allowed them to feel a little more at ease and not feel like they're going to be exploited, and kind of like they would open up to you and welcome you in with open arms.
That's right, and I think that's one of the reasons why their privacy is so important to me, you know, is I don't want them to be exploited, and you know, I really believe in what I do but I try to protect the people too, because they want to be protected.
Well, Dr. Clark, do you have any stories that you couldn't really fit in the book, or you just decided not to stick in there, that you'd be willing to share with us that maybe nobody else has really heard?
Well, you know, I have so many stories, and then I'm always out there, you know, out there collecting stories. And so it's hard for me. But I will tell you one story from this book that hasn't made it in any others. I was in a place near, in northern New Mexico, a couple of years ago, and the fan belt broke on my Subaru. And I got towed into this rickety old shop by this guy, and I met this mechanic who was quite a character. His name was Bo, and as we talked, he told me that his mother was Navajo and his father was white. He was a teacher on the reservation, and his mother met him and they got married. And he said that his father was killed in a car accident, and that when he was 16, his mother gave the money from his life insurance to him, and he started this little mechanic shop. And he would fix cars, and he said most of the time it was just tourists who were traveling that would stop at the dead of night and need help. And he said that he had been doing this for, you know, close to 50 years, and that his wife recently died, and one of the things that he would do, he and his wife would do on the weekends, is they would go out into the desert, and they would set up camp, and they would stay there and just spend the weekend there, that they loved to be out away from lights, and they could watch the stars. And he always took his guitar, and he liked to sing old cowboy songs, and they had a dog. And his wife had passed a couple of years ago, and he was still going out into the desert on the weekends. Well, this one particular weekend, he had gone out on Friday to spend the night, had planned on going in for a veterans ceremony on Sunday. So he was going to camp Friday night and Saturday night, and then get up early and leave for, so he could go to this ceremony at Four Corners. And he said that as he was settling in for the night, he was lying on his back, his dog was beside him, and all of a sudden, the entire sky went black. And he couldn't tell. He said at first he thought a storm had come in, but then he realized, because on the fringes of this, of the sky, he could see, still see the stars, and he realized that this huge UFO was hovering above him. And he said that he saw smaller craft zip out of this huge UFO, and then the large UFO just quickly disappeared into the sky. He said, you know, he sat up for a while longer, and then he thought, well, I'd just go to bed. There's nothing going on tonight. The next morning, he gets up, he said, and he's driving along this ridge, and he looks down, and he sees a landed UFO. And it has landed in an area that he has actually been in before. And he said it was near an old copper mine. And that these aliens, he said there were, he saw 11 in all. And he said they had these, there were taller aliens and then there were short ones. And that the short ones were going into this mine, even though it had been boarded up for almost a century. He said they were going into this mine and they were coming out with these rock samples and they were giving it to the large ones, the larger aliens, and they were examining them, and then they would throw aside the ones they didn't want, and then the ones they did, they would take with them. He said that he watched them for maybe an hour or so, and then he decided to take the loop around and get back to where he was camping and get his stuff. And he said as he started the loop around, he saw another group. This group was drilling, he said. They had a contraption, came out of the spacecraft, and was actually drilling in the ground. And they were taking core samples of the earth, he said. Now, I don't know what kind of core, I don't know how deep they were going down. He didn't know. And but anyway, he continued to tell me he became very concerned about what he was seeing, and he feels very strongly that something is going on. He went back home, and he set up some kind of a watchman's group that watch for these alien craft. He said that he thinks that they are here for resources, and they are checking out different places, and that they didn't expect, he was sure they didn't expect anybody like him to be out there and to see what they were doing. He said the next day he went down there, and he said that there was nothing, he could find absolutely no evidence of what they had been doing there. And he said he looked around for half a day. He said that his group, they watch and plan to follow up on anything that they see. He said that I don't think we're going to be willing to give our resources to the planet willingly. And he said, and I think they will take them. And he said, and I think they have the power to do it. So I don't think they're up to any good at all.
So it sounds like he may not think everything's going as good as everybody else might be.
So it was an interesting night that I spent with Bo.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story. It's an amazing book, Sky People, The Untold Stories of Alien Encounters in Mesoamerica. We really appreciate you coming on tonight. Is there any place that you're going to be speaking soon, or where can people go to buy the book?
Well, you know, at obviously at Barnes & Noble. Amazon.com and also at Amazon.com. And Barnes & Noble actually carries it in their shop. You can go to my website and click on the book, and it'll take you to Amazon. You can, my website is www.sixkiller.com. You can also write me at Ardy, A-R-D-Y, at sixkiller.com. You know, I'm always happy to hear from people who have stories to tell or who are fans or readers of my book. And I don't have a staff, you know, so I read them all and I answer them all myself. So if you want to get in touch with me, you'll be getting in touch with me, not some assistant.
Well, we appreciate you so much coming on the show and sharing your stories and writing this book. So thanks again and have a good day.
Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan's Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume. Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
And you're back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope everybody liked that interview with Clark. Really interesting stuff, like I spoke about before the interview. Interesting stories, you know, that I've never heard of before. I mean, I even like the ones with the gold ingots that the aliens, you know, apparently were paying them.
Yeah.
That is pretty cool. What story did you like from the book?
Man, there's a bunch of them in there that I really, really enjoyed, and that's why I had her talk about one of my favorite ones. And I love the one about Raul and Miguel, and it's a great story. There's so much more that goes into it than she tells. But the one with the silver man, where they found the guy, that's one of those things.
Oh, the little guy, right?
Yeah, the little
like
silver
the suit
man.
Or something. Yeah, that was a crazy story.
Well, it always hits me because it's one of those things that you can just tell that it really affected him, the man that found it. You know what I mean? And he took it in. And being a child, I mean, you're not knowing, and especially, I mean, we all would be guilty of the same thing. If you'd be finding something and trying to make money, and you got big, big Americans or big, big, wherever you're from, the big wigs in that area have come and you know, they're talking to you, and you really feel like you're part of their club now. You know, you're rubbing elbows with these guys, and, oh, yeah, I work for these guys, and you got all this pride, and you're like, well, I want them to like me more. It's almost like a peer pressure you bring on yourself.
Yeah.
So you go and find this, and then the first thing you do is you don't think about the repercussions or what good it would do for the world. You just run and give it to them.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Because you want to be liked. It's like trying to hang out with the cool kids, so you go buy the cool clothes, and you realize that it's really not what it's all about. So that was one of those things. That's that story that really hit home, because I was like, man. And yet again, it's one of those two. I'm like, why would he make it up? Why would you sit here and BS about finding something like that?
Right, exactly. That's my whole thing. It's like, why would you make that up?
He
knew to make that story up because fast forward 60 years from now, some woman from Montana is going to come down there and interview you about your story.
Right?
I mean,
yeah,
it's impossible.
Or the one in New Mexico where they talk about seeing, it's not even in the book. I mean, that's a story that she just received. She talks about seeing all that. So I don't know. I can't wait for her to do another one. It's just fun. I love the stories, the sightings. That's why we cover a lot of that on the show. That's the stuff that's entertaining. That's the stuff that's fun. It's awesome to think about all the sightings and the stories. And I don't know. I just loved it. But folks, before we wrap this little jewel up, you know, we've been trying to end on a good note all these time. Well, I don't know if anybody's been paying attention to this, but there was a fellow named Lewis Jordan. Now, Lewis Jordan went missing in January off the coast there in South Carolina. Yes. Well, he was found. He was found. Now, this has actually come out a few days ago. He was found Thursday afternoon on the capsized hull of his sailboat 200 miles east of Cape Hatteras in North Carolina. It says it's unclear how long he'd been living like that. But Lewis told his rescuers and TV reporters that he'd been catching and eating fish to survive. And he also told reporters overnight that he also drank rainwater, and he was forced to bail water out of the boat with one hand and arm because of a shoulder injury to his other arm. Now, he said, "I was just praying about you because I was afraid that you guys were crying and sad, and that y'all thought I might be dead." Now, that's what Lewis told his father. So he wasn't so much worried about himself as everybody else that might think he was dead and gone. He was worried about them, right? And then, of course, he had called his father. And, of course, he said, his dad goes, "Yeah, well, we were. I thought I had lost you," is what he said. So it ended up having a really, really a happy ending. Now, get this. He said Jordan told reporters that he was worried about dying on the ocean. And then he saw a German ship, and he waved his hands, and he blew a whistle that he had. He said when they finally saw the rear of the boat and he turned, he thought, "Oh, wow, this is it." So he was, imagine what joy that would be to actually be out there 200 days or so. You know, that's what it is. Yeah. I'm sorry, 200 miles, but just
66 days, right?
66. Okay. Now imagine being out there that long thinking you're going to die. You're
and that
probably
must
like,
seem like an eternity. 66 yeah. days out in the open ocean on your own.
Yeah.
With, like you said, luckily it rained. I mean, if it hadn't rained, what would he have drank? Well, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Yeah. Now, it said he was last seen leaving Bucksport Plantation Marina in Conway, South Carolina on January 23rd. And this was according to the Coast Guard actually saw that. But now his father called the Coast Guard from Charleston, South Carolina on the 29th because he hadn't heard from him at all. And then, of course, that's what got the ball rolling in this whole thing. So it's just a great story. It's just an all-around great story.
Again?
Would I, if it happened to me?
No, him. Do you think he will?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure he probably will. Because him just that little, what he was saying about it, about worrying about his father and worrying about his family back home. Yeah, he's not a guy that it just
doesn't seem like it affected him too bad.
It doesn't seem, it's almost one of those things. I remember reading a story or hearing a story about a man who went missing in the Australian outback. He carried a bunch of his gear and he had a Bible with him and he had all this stuff and he was walking and when he went missing and they went to trying to track him and find him and they were finding things that he had in his pack. And then they would find the pack, and it was just like he was just dropping stuff at random. And finally, they found his Bible on top of a rock, and he was nowhere to be seen. And it went for a long time, then they finally found him, alive. And they asked him why he threw all of his stuff away, and he said, "When you get to that one point, you realize you don't need anything anymore."
Right?
That it's not about that. And it's almost like it elevates you to a whole nother level of consciousness, a whole nother level of thinking of, you know, you kind of come to this realization. And I bet you have a real realization out there. Look, we could probably all last one night. It's like a rough time camping. We could probably all last two nights. Hell, maybe 4 or 5 nights we could all make it. But after about 2 weeks,
man,
when that realization sets in and you're just floating out there,
that's gotta
and
be
you're
terrifying.
Like, I've not seen a plane. I've not seen another ship. It's just me. Well, then that realization has to come in. You realize, especially at night, you're looking at the stars. You know, the rain comes through. You're doing what you can. You're trying to catch fish. You're trying to survive. And you realize you're like, I'm not near as big in this universe as I think I am when I'm back at my job.
Right.
I'm not near as important as I like to believe I am.
Yeah. Man, what an incredible story. But I'm glad they found him.
I think it's awesome. Yeah, it's an awesome. I love those tales of people rising above and persevering through it. Because it just makes you feel good, you know. And it's one of those things when you got to get up and go to work on like Monday, you're just like, oh, I don't want to get up. Well, you know what? You could be stranded in a boat for 66 days.
You know, good so point, good point.
You know, you get up and go to work, you're like, oh, hell, work ain't that bad after all.
Right? Well, speaking of work, don't work too hard this week. Stay safe. Make sure you wear your seatbelt. Take your vitamins. Maybe do a little exercise if you can.
Oh, I thought you was going to say ecstasy. I was like,
yeah,
whoa,
do,
where are you
do
going
a little ecstasy,
that?
Too. I mean, that'll probably
whoa, whoa,
help.
Whoa, 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 whoa. That's all on Kyle. It's not on me.
Well, we'll see those elite members on Thursday. We won't see them. We'll speak to them. For everybody else, we will talk to you next Monday. Peace.
Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is so delicious, so unbelievable, no word exists to describe it. It's better than mind-blowing, it's mouth-blowing. Bright, citrusy, and spicy, this newest flavor from Captain Morgan is a balanced blend of sweetness with delicious notes of lime and slightly spicy chili flavor that is great for an escape outdoors with your crew or your next hangout. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime is best enjoyed as an ice-cold shot or as a chili lime twist on a classic as a spicy daiquiri. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, a touch of sweet, a kick of heat. Please drink responsibly. Captain Morgan Sweet Chili Lime, premium Caribbean rum with natural flavors, 35% alcohol by volume, Captain Morgan Rum Co., New York, New York.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.